Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hey, Negotiations Ninja listeners, you've got Mark here. Welcome to this throwback edition of the show where we talk to my friend Mihai Isman, talking all about what it takes to get a deal done in multi-party negotiations. This is where you've got two or more parties that are present in a negotiation. Everyone wants something out of the deal, but how is everyone going to get everything that they want or need? We talk all about this in this great throwback edition with Mihai Isman. Mihai, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Nice having me again. How are you? I'm fine.
Good. I'm so glad, man. It's very exciting to have you on. And I'm very excited to get into this conversation because we've talked about it a little bit with a few other guests, but we've never really delved into the topic of multi-party negotiations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I find a lot of people get stuck in multi-party negotiations because there's so much going on. One-on-one is a lot easier usually to be able to deal with. But when you've got all of these disparate parties that may have interests in the negotiation,
it's overwhelming.
Very overwhelming. Before we get into the conversation today, maybe you could tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do.
Yes, it's my pleasure. My name is Mihai. I'm based in Germany, in Cologne, and I'm the head of an international negotiation consultancy. We're doing mostly commercial negotiations, but also like M&A negotiations or negotiations between HR and works councils and unions and political negotiations. And especially in those environments, you have a lot of multi-party negotiations because like union members or, you know, like political institutions and so on. So that's actually multi-party negotiations are our bread and butter kind of negotiations.
Fantastic. It's interesting that multi-party negotiations are your bread and butter, the sort of standard thing that you do. And I think it's fortuitous that we're having this conversation because I've been looking for someone who could provide expert level advice on this for quite some time. And I want to get into some broad discussions around this because I feel like that's probably a good place to start to sort of introduce the discussion. So when we're thinking about multi-party negotiations and all of the disparate parties that are involved and may have interests, what are some of the things that most people don't consider when they're actually in the negotiation?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mark. Most forget that each party is an agent for his group. So if they're used to negotiate one-on-one or one-on-two people at the table, it's quite simple. But if you keep in mind that every person there is a representative of a much larger group and the success of the external negotiation is highly dependable on the internal negotiation of this group, that you cannot influence it. And that's the challenge, because you don't know how well they are prepared, how well is the position aligned in the group. You have to face only with one representative of the group, and you have no idea and no clue what's behind it. And that's something that's always underestimated, and it's always a huge black box at the beginning.
Very common when it comes to like union negotiations or association-based negotiations, where they may be representing a group of members, a membership body, and then the other group may be representing a membership body, and then there may be like an industry organization that comes into it as well. And there's no way to know how well each individual group has prepared or at least sort out the input and the needs and wants of the people that they represent, isn't it?
Exactly. So just to give you an example, from 2 years ago, we had a huge multi-party negotiation with eight different groups, 23 people at the table with ministries, NGOs, lobbying groups, agricultural cooperatives, wholesale representatives, slaughterhouses, pig farmers, and supermarkets, and the ministry. So you have no idea how they prepared, and you have no idea about coalitions. You know, it wasn't in European member state, and those people are part of a supply chain and they interact with each other on a daily basis. So you have no idea who is liking whom, what are antagonists player at the table. So you have to figure this out really quickly. And the whole coalition dynamics also changes during the whole process.
You bring up a really interesting point. I think a lot of people maybe don't consider this as well. It's almost like the, I don't know if you remember the show Survivor, that reality show on TV where you would get voted off the island if you didn't make it, right? If no one liked you, you got voted off the island, basically. Mm-hmm. And in that show, it was very clear that in order to be able to survive and succeed, the people mm-hmm. within that show had to make alliances and coalitions with other people in the show to be able to move through the competition. Is it similar in multi-party negotiations?
Yes, it is. It is what you're faced with. And if you want to be successful, you need to A, understand these coalitions, and B, to be able to break them a little bit. You know, it sounds too aggressive to break it, but in order to shape a deal that is, it's okay for all parties, almost all parties, you have to break these blocks, because otherwise you don't overcome the position statement at the beginning. Every group is like, I'm fine with my position. And you have to figure out, is there a common ground? Is there a common sense that they want to do something with each other or not?
How do you even start that conversation? Because you've got, especially with the conversation that you were having, what were there, 18 different parties that sounded 18. Like 20 plus different parties that came into the conversation? And each of them has their own positions. Each of them wants and needs their own stuff. And they're coming in with their fists up, essentially. How do you even broach that conversation to be able to say, okay, where's the common ground where we can at least start the conversation?
Yeah. So, well, I'm also a mediator, and here my mediation skills are at use. So usually what we're doing is we start with one-on-one discussion. So I want to fully understand the perspective of this group on the whole negotiation, and being aware that it can be that they're lying to you because they play a show or they want to put themselves in a good position. Nevertheless, you learn something about their mindset, about how they approach the negotiation table. And then you can put questions about the other players at the table. So you have a slightly idea about the relationships of the players with each other. So then you can draw a stakeholder map. So we draw a stakeholder map, and then we work with this in the whole process because we are more people from our side of the table. So more pairs of eyes who are looking at it. And yeah, so that's the first step. I try to understand the position of every party. It's the elementary, because then they gain trust, because usually I am the neutral party. I am the one who's trying to bring all together, but they have to trust me, or at least to open a little bit in a discussion.
I love that. So you try to understand at least what the sort of the surface level positions are.
Exactly.
And from there, you can start to map out the stakeholders that are involved, how they're connected to each other, what alliances may exist. But then that stakeholder chart, does it change throughout the negotiation?
Yes, it does. Because some parties, if you're good and you manage that the groups suddenly talk about their positions and their true interests, it can happen that they understand more about each other. So they fought 2 months against each other. And now they see, well, but there is an opportunity to maybe a bilateral deal or something like that. And suddenly they're more open to some other parts, not to the whole group, not to the whole 8 members or 8 groups, but it shifts with more knowledge and more information that we're gaining through the process.
Amazing. Okay. So I want to try and break this down as much as possible. Step one, understand sort of the surface level positions, draw your stakeholder map. And then how do you get to the point of these are the surface level positions, but what are the interests behind those positions? And maybe we'll pause here for a sec. For the listeners, what we're talking about is the difference between positional and interest-based negotiation. A position might be, I want this thing, but the interest might be why you want that thing. So Mihai, can you maybe explain how you get from position to interest in these kinds of negotiations?
Mm-hmm. That's actually, it's every one-on-one discussion is a small negotiation itself, because I want to get exactly behind these positions. And you have to use your questioning techniques, you know, like basic questioning techniques. Be curious. That's the first part. Don't try to judge, and be curious and understand. And as a tactic, I like, my favorite tactic is play stupid and say, well, maybe it's on me. I don't understand, but how does this fit with that? And how is this player working with the other player? Tactical empathy, which you probably know also from the FBI techniques and so on and so on. That's no rocket science. I mean, you have to be trained to put good questions, but everyone who's negotiating knows how to put good questions. And you have to listen very, very carefully. And the second step in that, to getting further, is to, you have to design the process carefully. So you have to know which steps do you want to take? And the more complex the whole situation is, the more detailed your process and your preparation should be. And then, well, the third step is, as I said, mediate first. Try to overcome conflict. In this example where I told you with the eight parties, the slaughterhouses and the pig farmers, they had huge conflicts the last 4 years. If we didn't do a mediation before the actual negotiation, it would have been terrible because they have been so offended. They didn't talk to each other. They even didn't want to sit in physically in a room with each other. So sometimes if you're learning that the relationship between the parties is conflictual, you have to take care of the relationship first and then to come to the topics in the negotiation.
Because otherwise the negotiation is just not going to be productive.
Otherwise it's only a show. You know, like they're sitting there because the ministry ordered them to be there and, or they want to say, well, I'm playing by the game, but they won't move a centimeter.
So the mediation aspect in multi-party negotiations when it comes to this sounds like a very, very, very important piece. Oftentimes people, I think, discount the value of a neutral location, physical location, when this kind of stuff comes up. But maybe talk to me about how important a location is that makes sense for all parties.
Well, it's location has a symbolic, like in every negotiation, like everyone who's negotiating at his place feels comfortable and feels better in the situation. That the whole power place with a location you are aware of in the commercial aspect. In multi-party, well, I don't care about the location, Mark, really.
Okay, interesting.
So a neutral one is good. I've met situations where they have constraints about budgets or they don't agree who's paying for the location. So then we alternate. Let's see, if you have eight parties, you can easily design the process that every round, even mediation or negotiation, is in one place. So one of the negotiations was directly in the slaughterhouse. You know, it was freezing. That's good because the people didn't want to talk 5 hours. And every party can be a kind of guest, you know, like to show the place, to show how nice guests they are. So usually, to wrap up your question, usually try to negotiate in a neutral location.
I love that you had a conversation in a slaughterhouse.
Yeah, it was the first.
That feels symbolic to me.
Yeah, in a kind of way.
Like they're trying to send a message.
Exactly, like the old movies in Chicago, you know, like in the 50s.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show.
When you're trying to break down positions to understand interests in these multi-party negotiations, and you're also at the same time potentially creating coalitions and alliances between other parties, do you use it to further the cause of all parties involved? Or if you see that a potential deal isn't going to take place, do you potentially just create multiple bilateral agreements?
Yeah, that was something that I had to learn during my years. You know, you start with a romantic view and say, well, eight parties, 36 people, I'm here, and then all of them will be happy. The truth is, you have to be okay to reach only 80% agreement. You have to be okay that from eight parties, maybe one doesn't want to. But if all seven find a viable solution for themselves and they can go on further, that should be okay. And well, it depends on what professional ethic you have or what professional attitude you have. At the beginning, I want everyone to be happy, and you learn it's not possible. So you have to be pragmatic. And sometimes if you realize that, well, you solved the problem, not the whole problem, but a certain aspect of it, maybe that's enough.
Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the deal isn't over. It just means that 3 years from now or 4 years from now, potentially you go at it again and see how you could potentially tie in the other parties.
Exactly. Especially if, you know, like circumstances are changing and so on. And what I've also learned is you have to be careful to look about behind the parentheses, you know. I'm taking again the situation with the pig farmers. And I remember after the first interviews, we had the idea, well, these are poor people. I mean, they're at the end of, well, at the beginning of a supply chain, but if you follow the money back, they get a lot of peanuts or pennies for the dollar. And suddenly we realized, well, these people have a lot of land. You know, one of them told me, well, if I am selling my farm, I have X million euros and I'm a millionaire. So I don't care if they want to deal with me or not, you know, like the whole power play. And suddenly you realize, well, they're not as poor as you might think, you know, and you have to get past your own sympathies or antipathies for one of the parties. Otherwise, you will always advocate for unilaterally for some reason or some party, and then you won't be able to get all of the table.
Interesting. So not only do you have to like manage the interests and positions of the other parties, but you also have to break down your own preconceived ideas about where each party is financially, economically, all that kind of stuff. Wow, I never thought of it from that perspective. Do you bring a team into this to help you with that? Because I find it hard to be able to reflect on the situation to determine whether or not I have preconceived biases before I come in. What do you do around that?
Absolutely. So in such negotiation with such proportions, we are always minimum two people, but let's say an average four people from our side. Also to, you have then four different perspectives for people look at the same discussion or the same interview in four different ways. We understand something different. We talk through our prejudice. And it's also like an internal negotiation for our part, how to proceed, how what we've learned and so on. And it's important, otherwise you're biased, and you can get lost in sympathies and the whole dynamic of the process that you even don't recognize it for yourself. Only after it's over and then some party claims that, well, you said this and that, and that's why I didn't agree.
Fascinating. One of the tools that I really love whenever a difficult negotiation is about to come up is the idea of doing a pre-mortem before going in to understand what could go wrong. And if it could fail, where could it fail? Do you use a similar tool?
Yeah, we use actually pre-mortem. It's one of my favorite tools because we avoid over-optimism, you know, and that's often the case.
Yeah. And most people, like the funny thing about negotiation, when like if the listener is listening to this, they're probably thinking, wait, I thought I was supposed to be optimistic about the negotiation. And that's true, but there's a difference between optimism and over-optimism because there's optimism bias that comes into play as well. Maybe you could walk the listeners through a little bit about sort of what optimism bias is to you and how that might affect your negotiation if you didn't do the pre-mortem analysis.
Well, how it will affect? Well, you don't think clearly in the process. So you bias yourself because you will search for self-fulfilling answers and for reactions of your counterpart that answer exactly your hypothesis or your over-optimistic hypothesis. And you have to be prepared to fail every step of the process. And yeah, the more party at the table, the higher the deadlock risk is there. So it doesn't serve you to be naive or to think that you alone will rescue this negotiation, because usually the people, they're dealing with each other over a couple of years. It's like a family sometimes, at least in our example that I told you was. So they had fights over years, they come together over years, they exchange spouses over years, I don't know. And you don't understand these dynamics. So it's good to be optimistic when you start a process. No one should lose, no negotiator should lose his optimism in, I can solve this. I can help them come together. Because that's important. That should be your driver. But if you think that only me can save that, the truth will probably be very hard to you in the whole process.
Yeah, you're in for a bit of a rude shock.
Exactly, yeah. And this pre-mortem helps you frame your thinking that it might go wrong, and reflect on what do I have to do that it goes wrong. So to be aware on what shall I avoid during the whole process if I don't want to fail.
Very, very interesting. I think one of the big things that I'm getting out of this is preparation, planning, strategy, and going through all of the what-if scenarios prior to each meeting is absolutely critical to maintain a modicum of success in multi-party mm-hmm. negotiations.
Exactly. That's the main lesson. Second is handle conflict, handle relationship before topics.
Yes.
Because you need at least a basic level of trust with the players in each other. You need to use back-channel diplomacy. So, you know, like the romantic idea that 23 people sit at the table all the time and negotiate through days. Sometimes it's not effective. So you have to work with the players one-on-one. Look beyond appearances, understand roles, groups, dynamics, and especially intercultural aspects. Mm. What I forgot to tell, from these 23 people, they spoke three languages, French, English, German, and they were from different cultures. So it's a real mess. Accept 80% solutions, be prepared to fail, be patient, because such negotiations take time. So it took 12 months to reach an agreement, an 80% agreement. So there are no quick wins, you know, like it's a marathon. You have to be prepared that it takes time, but it's nevertheless satisfying.
Yeah, very satisfying when you come out with a result at the end that's really positive, because 80% with like 8 different parties and 20 plus people is a real accomplishment. That's very impressive. So when you're thinking about this and you're thinking about all the different cultures that are involved as well, and you know, multi-party has multiple cultures, is there a base language that everyone speaks in this context, or do you encourage the use of one language at a time to maintain sort of the same level of understanding?
We had to do it in English.
Interesting.
Because some of the French didn't speak German. And so it was the common language. Nevertheless, that's why in our team, we had 2 French natives and 2 English natives. And I'm German native. So because there are situations and English was no mother language of none of them. So you have misunderstanding opportunities that are huge. Once I had a multi-party negotiation in Madrid, and they had in the room, they had microphones, you know, like in the 40s or 50s, where you had to push a button and then to talk to them. And the Spanish said, no, English is possible. We don't want English. We can speak French. Well, I said, okay, we can speak French too. Then we sat at the table and the French was like, no one from France understood them. And then they brought in translators.
Mm-hmm.
And then you mess up the whole process because you don't have any conversation anymore. You're like, they say something, the translator translates it. Maybe there are failures in community. I don't know. Then you have to understand it and then you reply and the whole, you know, like the negotiation is
then. It's so hard to do translation. I remember a situation where I had to negotiate with someone who spoke a different language and she could speak English fluently. Mm-hmm. She just refused to speak English to me. So I had to bring in a translator for her so that she could speak her language to me, translate it through the translator. I could get it in English. And then I would speak it back. So she would hear it twice, but I'd only hear it once. And the once that I would hear it in would be broken because it would be interpreted differently from the translator. That was a challenging negotiation.
So she was from Quebec, right?
I can't say. Listen, this has been a fantastic discussion. I've really, really enjoyed having you on talking about multi-party negotiations. There's so many different rabbit holes that I think that we could go into here, but I think you've outlined things so well. And I think the thing that anyone who's listening needs to think about is before you go into a multi-party negotiation, recognize that it's a very different animal to sort of a one-on-one style negotiation. And you're going to have to do a significant amount of planning and preparation and adjustment throughout and managing your own expectations. Mihai, if people want to reach out to you and they want to talk to you more, how do they do that?
Well, you can find me on every channel out there. You know, like the website is smileandpartners.com. Through LinkedIn, through Instagram, through, I don't know, Facebook, we have presence everywhere. Let's get in touch. I'd be happy to help you. I'd be happy to share my knowledge. It's no rocket science. It's a bit more messed up and more complicated, but it's solvable. So have fun, enjoy it. If you like people, if you like negotiating, and if you like communication, then you should at least try one multi-party negotiations. You will learn a lot of things out of it.
Totally. Thank you so much for being on and sharing your wisdom, man.
Thanks for having me, Mark. And take care, stay safe in those crazy times, and see you again.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.